Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Charlwell Borough Council's Member Conduct Committee meeting. We've had apologies from the Vice Chair, and we've just learned that the Chair has also sent his apologies. So can I ask somebody to nominate or volunteer to be Chair?
Councillor Rowlands.
I'm happy to.
Is everybody happy, Councillor Rowlands, to be Chair? Yeah. Thank you. Councillor Rowlands, I'll hand over to you then.
Thank you. So, item 2 minutes of the previous meeting.
Before you move on, Sorry. Chair, there's also apologies from Councillor Ward, and she has got Councillor Beer in substitute, and there's also apologies from Councillor Ball.
Thank you. So, item 2 minutes of the previous meeting. So, to confirm as an accurate record, the minutes of the meeting held on the 13th of January 2022. So, we'll take those as read, but if we could have a quick show of hands to approve those minutes, please. Okay, so we've got three there and a couple of sentences, I assume, to read at the meeting. So that's fine. So item 3, disclosures of pecuniary interests and or registrable and non-registrable interests. So do we have any from anybody in the room this evening? No, thank you very much. Item 4, questions under committee procedure 12.8. No questions have been received. So item 5, update on complaints received. So this is a report of the monitoring officer providing an update on complaints received about breaches of the code of conduct and any issues arising from those complaints. So we're joined by Adrian Ward, the monitoring officer, so I'll hand over to him for this item.
Thank you, Chair. So this is an update on complaints received since the last meeting of the committee in June. I'm very pleased to say there are no new complaints that we've had about either borough councils or any of our parish and town councils. So it's just a very brief update in the appendix, bringing us up to speed on the two complaints that had already been in progress. So one of which there is a hearing scheduled in a few weeks' time, and the other one at the fact-finding stage, we determined that there was no breach of the code of conduct, so that didn't need to progress to a hearing. And obviously, happy to take any questions.
Any questions from anybody? No? Great. So, I move on to item 6, review of the constitution. Again, this is a report of the monitoring officer to enable the committee to review the council's constitution. So, again, I'll hand over to our monitoring officer, Adrian Ward, for this item.
Thank you, Chair. So this process will feed into the annual review of the Constitution. I have been through the arrangements for dealing with complaints about member conduct section within the Constitution, and you'll see in the appendix highlighted in red the suggested changes. There are no fundamental changes, it's just really tidying up and bringing some of the process in line with actual practice. So there are no substantive changes that we're proposing. It is a tidy up and a general bringing up to date. And this is also the opportunity for the committee to raise any other issues that they would like to consider, again, to feed into the ongoing review of the Constitution.
Thank you. Any questions from anybody about the changes or any new suggestions? Councillor Drake Hogg.
Yes, a few, please, Chair. On page 18.4, it talks about the red reserves are permitted just because of recent events, and would like to know or be assured that reserves are or receive some sort of training regarding conduct and whether that needs to be actually put in the document. So that's my first question. Do you want to do them one by one? Or
how many are there?
About three or four.
I think it's up to you, Adrian.
Deal with them one by one.
Yeah, fine.
So yes, if it's actually very rare to have to use reserves for hearings. The situation that cropped up recently was the first time it had happened in a decade. Just to reassure members of the committee, I do provide training on a one-to-one basis for reserves who have not previously been involved with the Member Conduct Committee. So the reserve that will be attending the panel in a few weeks' time has had a one-to-one training session.
Does that need going in the document, though? Just the transparency?
I think through you, Chair, it is probably under section 2, who does what, where we've got a list of the committees, and then under the Member Conduct Committee, it says that the monitoring officer provides training as required for, and I think it's got panels in there as well.
Right, it's covered.
So it is already sort of detailing the training part.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Second question is about page 19, where it states in red, the monitoring officer will appoint a suitable person. I just wonder what suitable actually implies, because what's being crossed out is another person appointed. So why the change of wording? And I'm not quite sure whether suitable, you know, if you remember the public reading that, you know, how would you look at it, sort of thing?
Okay, so just to explain, the original wording said that either myself as the monitoring officer or another person appointed by me would carry out the investigation. I don't think it would be appropriate for me to undertake an investigation myself if I'm then advising the panel, considering my own investigation report. And in practice, I've over the last 11 years, I've always appointed somebody else to do the investigations for me. And I don't think it would be appropriate for me to undertake the investigation myself, which is why I've clarified in the wording that I will appoint somebody to undertake the investigation. The person appointed, it will depend on the circumstances of the complaint and the complexity. So there are a number of private sector firms that specialise in member conduct investigations that we have used in the past. There is a company that advises on member conduct issues that have a bank of investigators, sort of experienced investigators that they can refer monitoring officers to across the country. I have more recently started using fellow monitoring officers from other district councils within Leicestershire. So we have an informal arrangement where if they have the capacity to do it, we will help each other out. So rather than undertaking our own investigation, we do the investigation with one of our neighbouring monitoring officer colleagues. Or alternatively, if it's a really concise and sort of isolated matter that doesn't require a huge amount of expertise or specialist knowledge, I have on occasion appointed other officers from within the council to undertake investigations, because I think it's useful for them to build up their knowledge and expertise of member conduct matters. It doesn't happen very often, but over the years we have on occasion used internal staff. So it's suitable person, really. It's a professional investigator. It's a monitoring officer or a deputy monitoring officer from one of the neighbouring district councils in Leicestershire, or if it's a simpler complaint, less complex complaint, I will appoint somebody potentially from within the officer corps to undertake the investigation. Obviously they will have coaching and support from myself and Karen if it's the first time they've done that sort of investigation.
Do they need a particular training? Do they need a particular training?
We normally do it by informal coaching. I mean, the people I've used in the past, we used solicitors from within the legal team, who obviously have a forensic type background in terms of gathering evidence and interviewing witnesses. When we had a matter a few years ago that involved a breakdown in relationships between two councillors, one of them ended up with a complaint being submitted by a councillor against another councillor, I used Kevin Bruin, that's his area of expertise, is relationships and so I used Kevin on that occasion. So that we don't normally train them, and I wouldn't give them a complex investigation. It would have to be a very straightforward, discreet, single point an issue where I felt they had some background or expertise that they could bring to bear on the complaint, really.
Okay.
Going back then to the three examples that you gave, I think they would be better set out in that document. looking at it from the member of the public needing it, you know, the monitoring officer picking a suitable person, whereas I think it would look better if those examples were listed in the document for a member of the public to read. I wonder if that was possible, Chair.
I mean, I'm obviously thinking on my feet, I wouldn't want to fetter my discretion too much, because if somebody from those sources weren't available, I would then have nobody to turn to, if that makes sense.
No, but you could put like a fourth example, you know, in exceptional circumstances, other options will be looked at. So you could still do that and cover up all of your options, just put another one at the end.
I think the only comment I would have on that is it's an improvement. What's in here now is an improvement on what was there before, which gave the monitoring officer the discretion to appoint anybody, because he at that point could appoint another person. There's no requirement on him to even make sure that they are suitable. So I would be cautious about being too prescriptive with a list that we use, because at that point, I appreciate we could have some kind of a general exemption, but I'd worry about putting a prescriptive list as to what exactly we need the background to be, because it might be that the complaint is a really niche matter that we've got an officer that lends themselves well to dealing with it, but otherwise on paper wouldn't appear to be the right person to investigate member conduct issues. I think that's the point that the monitoring officer is making, that sometimes a council officer might be used that wouldn't ordinarily be used, but it makes sense at that time. So I'm comfortable with suitable on the basis it's an improvement on the existing wording, which is anybody could be appointed.
Well, if I could come back, it doesn't say any other person, it says or another person appointed by the monitoring officer. So if that's the position, I would actually prefer the original wording. Because, you know, suitable to me makes it kind of personal. So I would just like that recorded in the minutes, Chair, that I would prefer the original word in there. Thank you. And then my fourth, I think it's my third or fourth, is why all of the sections on page 27, 28 and 29 are being removed. I realise they're sort of the script for a panel, right? But I think that is interesting information for members. So it just seems to me unnecessary to delete all of that.
I think, Chair, on that point, if you look at this is a section that relates to non-code of conduct complaints, and the previous section relates to code of conduct complaints,
yeah.
And the process is exactly the same. So rather than repeat it all, I've just added the extra words. You'll see at the bottom of what's been deleted, it says the hearing process as set out in section 18.8 will be followed. So the process is still set out in the document, it's just a question of removing the duplication.
So where's the original duplication?
Well, 18.8.
On what page?
It's not shown in that report, I think that's the problem. It's in the Constitution, but only a section of the Constitution has been cribbed. So I think 18, I don't think that actually shows in the report.
Page 23.
If you look at section 18.8, it sets out the process for the hearing in relation to code of conduct.
Oh, sorry, you're right. Page 23, it is on there.
Starting on page, the bottom of page 23.
Yeah.
And it's the same process, basically. So I thought, rather than repeat it all twice, let's just cross-reference back to the first section in which it's set out.
Right, I don't think that's clear in the report, but if that's what you're saying, okay. And then my final is a question to do with exempt reports for members. I tried to find any kind of guidance or that in the Constitution and couldn't. And as you're aware, Adrian, at a recent meeting, I requested such a document and was told I couldn't have it. I was also told that if I turned up, the likelihood is that I'd be asked to leave. Mm-hmm. And as an elected member, I've been here about 6 or 7 years, I've always had access to exempt documents. And they've had sensitive information, financial, business, all sorts of things in those reports. So as an afterthought, I think, you know, it somewhere needs to be set out what the rules are regarding exempt reports.
So through you, Chair, there's a section in the Constitution called the Access to Information.
Yes, that's
rules.
Right. So, yes, there's a
different. And this is all set out in there. Now,
do
what
you know
that basically
says.
Sorry?
I think it's. I'd have to double check. I haven't got my constitution in front of me, but I think it's chapter 10, I think.
I'm going to send you the link.
Please, if you would, yeah. Yeah. I couldn't find anything. Yeah.
Just to try and explain briefly, Chair, all councillors can have access to exempt reports that relate to executive, i.e., cabinet matters. That's not the case with exempt reports that relate to council matters, and the member conduct process is a council function, not an executive function.
Right, okay. And that will be in chapter 10,
yes.
Or yeah, I think that if you send it. Yep. That's it, thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Councillor Howard, do you have a point on
18.5? I'm just supporting your point of view.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments at all?
Karen, is it the time to bring up my issue?
I think first of all, maybe the committee
should do a vote on
this section,
yeah,
and then
okay,
I know your point is about another matter.
Okay, fine. So firstly then, let's take a vote on the amendment suggested by the monitoring officer. So I think if we just have a show of hands, all those in favour of the changes as drafted, please. Okay, so we've got four. Any against? No? Abstention? There's one abstention, okay, fine. So that will be carried then with those amendments, Councillor Howe.
I'd just like to thank the monitoring officer for doing all the work on the report and answering all the questions that were raised tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. So if we move on to any other changes then that people may want to discuss about the Constitution, I think that's where your point will come in.
Okay. Right, bear with. Okay. Now, I don't really like philosophical discussions and abstract discussions, but actually I like to address things which are coming from real events. And what's happening in this case, there was a real event where actually there was a meeting, a committee meeting, and halfway through the proceedings, a councillor sitting in this committee was approached to be informed that there is a problem, there is a concern about conflict of interest. The councillor felt very embarrassed, he was taken by surprise, and he left the room. After the end of the proceedings, actually I asked Councillor Mark Charles, just to be specific, I said, so Mark, what was your conflict of interest? And he was embarrassed. He said, I didn't really know that, but because I was elected in this ward. Now, actually, for me, this raises some serious issues here. And that's why I bring it up, actually, in the Constitution matters. The first issue is actually anybody, the monitoring officer, but any member of the public, any other councillor can say actually to me, for example, you have a conflict of interest. And then I will be embarrassed and shocked. And I may be forced or asked to leave a committee. Is this giving me the opportunity to defend myself? Because I may have a different opinion. My opinion is, no, I don't have a conflict of interest. So there is no time given, there is no right given to the councillor to defend himself or herself. And I think this is pretty serious. And actually, to add to this, when we say actually, I think you have conflict of interest, so you have to leave this committee, then there should be actually some evidence provided. For example, if we talk about budgets, and somebody says to me, oh, I overheard you in the pub talking against budgets. It's a different thing than actually, oh, you bring the leaflet against the budgets. Then you have some evidence, but actually I don't think actually if somebody saying, I overheard you talking against the budgets and the budget set, constitutes actually significant evidence. And again, I don't really understand If actually somebody says to me that I have a conflict of interest and I disagree with this one, and I don't have conflict of interest, I stay and I vote, then is there any arbitrary process for this one? So this is actually the first part. The second part, which I very strongly feel we need to address, is actually that being elected in a particular ward, constitute ward division or constituency, constitute automatically a conflict of interest and exclude you from taking part in proceedings involving matters in this particular ward, division, or constituency. Because, first of all, this defies logic and defies democracy.
Okay, I'll hand over to Munchausen then to respond to that point, I think.
Thank you, Chair. So, firstly, myself and Karen, we've discussed this at some length, and neither of us can recollect being at the Plans Committee meeting in question, so I don't think that advice came from us. Mm-hmm. Being a ward councillor in itself does not mean that you cannot consider, as a Plans Committee members, applications within your ward. That has to be something more than just being the ward councillor. So if you have been, you know, in working with residents to either support or object to that planning application, and you having some sort of connection in that respect to the planning application, then the councillor would have to go through the normal thought process about whether you have an open mind, whether you are biased. But just being a ward councillor in itself should not mean that you cannot sit as a Plans Committee member and consider applications within your ward.
I welcome this, but is this clarified anywhere actually in training or in the constitution?
Well, the code of conduct gives a great deal of guidance on categories of interest, and there's a flow chart to go through to work out whether or not you have an interest and if you do, what you need to do about it. So there's pages of guidance. It's not obviously straightforward sometimes, which is why we always advise councillors to come and speak to us, if possible, in advance of the meeting, to run through whether they have an interest or not, and if so, what they should do about it. It's very difficult as an officer, but particularly in relation to the new code of conduct that was introduced last year, to give advice on the hoof in a meeting, because it is quite complex. There's pages of guidance and a very complicated flowchart.
Adrian, sorry, I'm a bit confused. You said this is clarified in the Constitution. If it is clarified in the Constitution, the removal of Mark Charles from this Plans Committee was against the Constitution.
So well, that would have been under the previous code of conduct.
Yeah.
If it was a couple of years ago, the new code was introduced about 12 months ago.
In May this year.
But Chair, if I could just carry on. So what the new code of conduct says in section 8 is, when reaching decisions on any matter, I will have regard to any relevant advice provided to me by officers and professional third parties. And there's then an explanatory paragraph underneath, and this is actually in the code of conduct in the constitution that I hope addresses the concern. So I'll read it out word for word. To assist members in acting lawfully, officers may give advice from time to time. It is important that as a member you have due regard to any such advice given and consider it fully, even if, brackets, for good reason, close brackets, you may choose not to follow that advice. So the current code of conduct within the constitution says that
councillors...
Which
page is this one?
Sorry?
This is in the
constitution.
In the constitution. Yeah. So the current code of conduct within the constitution places a duty on members to have regard for advice given by officers and to consider it fully, but it does make it very clear that you can choose not to follow that advice. But then the supplementary guidance produced by the Local Government Association on the new National Code of Conduct says, and again I'll read it word for word, if you seek advice as an individual councillor or advice is offered to you, for example, on whether or not you should register or declare an interest, you must have regard to this advice before you make your mind up. Failure to do so may lead to a breach of the code of conduct. But again, what that supplementary guidance is saying is you have to have regard to the advice, and if you choose not to follow it, you must have a good reason not to follow it, but you can choose not to follow it. But you have to consider it, and you have to have a good reason not to follow it. So if in a situation where somebody suggests you have a conflict of interest, and as a councillor you are absolutely convinced that you do not have a conflict of interest, then you can choose to stay in the meeting.
But do you have time to reflect? What time do you give the councillor to reflect about the conflict of interest? Because sometimes things are not black and white. And sometimes actually I may go home and say to myself, possibly I had a conflict of interest. Or that possibly I didn't. So you see, yeah. I'm going back to the previous example, because actually when we go into a situation where you're actually halfway through proceedings and somebody raises an issue, you're taking the person by surprise. So you don't give the person the time to reflect, which for me it is an issue.
I agree. I think, as I said, Chair, myself and Karen will always encourage councillors to make sure they read all of their reports well in advance and come to us if they believe they have any potential conflict of interest issues that they need some advice on. And it's very, very difficult for anybody, either officers giving advice or councillors in a meeting, if something crops up there and then, and it's in the meeting, it's very difficult for officers to give advice. And I can fully appreciate it would be equally difficult for councillors to have the time to go through a measured thought process. So the only advice I could give in that situation, if something crops up or somebody says, Councillor Bloggs, I think you have conflict of interest, I think as a councillor you'd be perfectly entitled to ask the chair for a short adjournment of 5 minutes so you can go away and potentially get advice from myself, Karen, or other officers that may be there, and just have a pause so you have time to think about whether or not you do have a conflict of interest.
Councillor Mayor.
Cheers. Thank you. Just the 2 points I want to pick up is that ultimately it's up to the councillor to decide whether they have a conflict of interest or not. If an officer's giving you advice that you potentially might have it, you should consider it. As I've said, you don't have to consider it, but it's there to protect us as individual councillors, especially if it's a planning committee. But ultimately, and Andrew's covered this off, is that you should know beforehand if you have a conflict of interest or potential conflict of interest, so you can then talk it through to officers before you actually sit in the meeting. If it is a planning application and it's in your own ward, I would have had that advice before sitting on that particular meeting, or I would have subbed myself off to say, actually, it's contentious, potentially contentious, I've spoken on it or not spoken on it, whatever it may be, but I don't think it's good for me to be here, let somebody else in my group sit on that one. I've been given advice before, and I've asked for advice before in full council meetings. We've done it several times, in budget times, really. And we've not just myself, several of us walked out because of the advice we were given, and it was like one person walks out and you think, actually, do I have conflict of interest because I might have the same interest or similar interest, and that person walked out as well. And there was no time given, it's just that we thought at that time that's the best course of action, and so we left the meeting. But then we have to trust the judgment of all the others on the committee.
But we do agree that actually being elected in a ward does not automatically constitute a conflict of interest.
Yeah, but that's not
that,
good
enough. In terms of the planning code, that is correct. It's in the planning code, but so in terms of that particular planning issue, if you are a ward council and you have a planning application in your ward, and as Adrian says, you've not had any other connection to that particular planning application, you do not have to be the plans committee.
No. Karen?
I was just about to say, obviously we've spoken about this matter, and you were concerned that there was nothing in the current code of conduct about this. It is set out in the current code of conduct, which was only adopted in May this year. I know that other event you were referring to was about a couple of years ago now, I think. So it is in the current code of conduct, and I hope that allays your fears, and potentially when Adrian and myself do the training, induction training with members after the elections, maybe we highlight that particular section. I know we have in the past, but...
Sorry, it just happens that by chance I have the Planning Code of Good Practice copied out. So in section 7.1 of the Planning Code of Good Practice, it talks about the role of ward members sitting when they sit on the Plans Committee. And it says, when determining planning matters, your duty is to the whole community and not just to the people in your ward area. You must ensure that decisions are impartial and you should not improperly favour or appear to improperly favour any person, company, group or locality, including the residents of your ward. So it's very clear that as a ward councillor, you can make decisions on planning applications that relate to your ward, but you must, when you're acting as a member of the Plans Committee, you are representing the whole borough.
Keep an open mind.
Not just your own ward.
So I think actually I'm pretty pleased that we clarified these two issues, because these two issues have been discussed for the last 2 years quite extensively in my ward.
But I think the overriding message is, being a ward councillor does not mean that you can't sit on the Plans Committee and consider applications in your ward in itself. But you may have contact with applicants, with residents. That means you would have to go through the court process as to whether or not you do still have an open mind. But just being a ward councillor in itself doesn't mean you're automatically excluded from all planning decisions in your ward.
I will be really grateful if you clarify these two issues actually in all training sessions as from now on, because I don't want what happened back then to repeat itself. Please.
Okay. I'm going to show you if Councillor Jones has got anything to add. She's on the screen up there. No? Okay, thank you. Anybody else? Any points on that one? No? Okay, so I think we can move on then from item C.
Yeah, the only thing is for you, Chair, is I just. The issue about the planning code is probably something that we would need to talk to the head of planning about, because I think it's his responsibility to do the training for that particular element of the constitution. So.
Oh yes, that's right.
If the committee is happy for me to just pass that off communication on
as an action from this meeting, yes, that's good.
Yeah. Thank you. Great. So on to item 7, which is our work programme. Again, this is a report amongst us to enable this committee to agree a work programme to plan its future business. So again, I'll hand over to Monson Officer Adrian Ward for this.
Thank you, Joe. This is really just an information item, so if you look at the appendix, there are two items to be scheduled. One is the review of local government ethical standards, when the government responds to the Committee on Standard and Public Life recommendations, and I'm not aware that the government have responded yet. And review the constitution of the wrong side. They're too linked really, that if and when the government does respond, then we think about any changes that we need to the constitution. This has been on the work programme now for several years. 3 years?
It has three years.
So it's whether you want to leave it there as a place marker or whether you think it's worth removing it until such time as the government does or does not. I mean, they may never respond, so it may just sit there forever. Or whether you rely on myself and Karen to keep monitoring the situation, and if and when there's an update, we bring it back into the work programme.
I think probably given we're going to have a new council next year, it probably ought to, at least for the next year, stay on, in my view, just whilst this committee will probably change completely from next May. So I think whilst that transition happens to the new council next year, we probably ought to keep it on after that. The new committee can take a decision, I think. Has anyone else got any comments on that at all? No? Are we happy to leave it on for another year and then look at bring it off then if that's the right time? Okay, great. Anything else on that?
One.
No. Okay, fine. So that leaves nothing more than to close the meeting. So thank you all for attending. Next meeting is 13th of March 2023, so I guess have a good Christmas. Thank you.
Happy Christmas.
Thank you all.